Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, you'll hear an exclusive interview with musician Rufus Wainwright, conducted by the HE Band's own Eli Janney. They discuss Rufus's career in music and their shared experiences in the industry. Now let's go to Eli and Rufus.
Hello, Late Night podcast listeners. This is Eli Janney from the HE Band, and my guest today is the wonderful Rufus Wainwright. Rufus has created 10 full-length albums, including 3 live albums, 2 operas, has collaborated with Robert Wilson on a theater show, setting Shakespeare to music. He's also won a Grammy, a Brit, and 2 Juno Awards.
I haven't won a Grammy. Oh, well, I sort of won. I had a song that was on a Grammy-winning
record. Yes, that counts.
Yeah, yeah. So I have a chink.
There you go. See? His most recent single, Sword of Damocles, is a political parable directed at Donald Trump.
Yes.
Welcome.
Thank you.
How are you today?
I'm good. I'm having a beautiful day here with your fabulous
entourage. With our whole show and crew.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. No, it's been lovely.
So just for our listeners who may not know you as well, you were born into a very musical household.
Yes.
Both your parents were very established musicians. But you've never shied away from performing or writing.
Was it just assumed that you were going to be?
It was
assumed very early on.
Really?
I mean, there's many kind of faded 70s Polaroids of me in diapers kind of reaching towards the piano in agony. There was never a line drawn between, you know, me and the stage.
Your parents were just totally into it. My mom
was into it. My dad was horrified.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I think he was just, because he was a performer. He's a great singer-songwriter, still works today. And I think he was, you know, pretty set in being the center of attention the star of the show.
Right.
And then all of a sudden this toddler, you know, was kind of trying to take over. And my mom instantly, you know, took that on as her co-celeb as well. So it was, and this is all in the midst of 70s, you know, folk rock divorce situation. So
you started performing with her very early, right?
Around 6, you know.
That's pretty early, I guess. That's pretty early, yeah.
What happened is that my mom, you know, once she and my dad split up, she took my sister and I up to Canada.
Right.
And we were brought up in Canada because she was Canadian. And she and her sister Anna, who were part of the McGarrigle Sisters, which were a great duo, they really toned it down in terms of their touring to bring up children. And so we weren't, you know, dragged throughout the world.
Oh, you weren't raised on
buses.
The road.
No,
exactly.
We weren't. No,
oh, okay,
no.
Okay. But you have been touring on your own as your own artist for a long time.
Yes.
I toured basically from 2001 to 2002 and then had kids and I started like stop touring, but you've just kept on powering on through.
Yeah.
And has it changed a lot, your attitude towards the stage?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I have this constant memory to this day where I remember it was I'd finished my first album 20 years ago, and I had some show opening up for someone in D.C., and the record company had sent a limo for me, which is, you know, ancient history. and I got in the limo, and it was, and I remember it was springtime, and the cherry blossoms were out, yeah, you know, in Washington. And I was kind of driving along this road, and the cherry blossoms were kind of blowing in the wind, and I was off, and I remember distinctly saying, this is the beginning of the rest of my life of touring. I could totally see at that moment that this was, you know, the beginning of a 20-year at least process. So I it always harkens back to that moment.
Wow. That's a pretty good one. That's pretty funny. In a limo with blossoms coming down. Yeah, that's amazing.
Gone, you know, distinctly downhill.
But it's must have gone.
In many ways, you know, when you think of it happening in DC.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. I grew up in D.C. I know all about it, believe me. But now you're out there touring on Poses, right? Is this what this tour is?
Yeah, well, this tour is a 20th anniversary celebration of my first two albums. It's the, my 20 years ago was Rufus Wainwright, my eponymous debut, and then we did Poses. So this tour is both of those records.
Did you always play those songs off
that
record?
Yeah, I played a lot of them over the years.
But you never went through a period. I know some musicians, they go through a period, especially if they have like a hit. They can't stand the song after a while.
Well, I had that somewhat with the song Hallelujah, because I did a version of that for Shrek years ago that stuck, and for many people that's how they identify me is with that song,
really?
Hallelujah. So and as we all know, and even Leonard would tell me that it's, you know, we're pretty sick of that number.
That's amazing.
But it does not seem to want to go away.
And for
a long time I was a little frustrated about it, but now I've embraced it and I owe a lot to that.
That's
piece
good
of music.
You still perform it live?
Yes, I do. I do.
Weddings,
funerals, political events.
I have two teenage boys, and even they like, oh yeah, yeah, we know that song.
Yeah,
like,
that's a song. I
was like, yeah, he did a very popular version of that song.
Yeah.
I just wonder, because some people go through periods where they hate the song and then they come back to it. But going back,
I mean, I had actually agreed. I had made a sort of deal with myself that I wouldn't sing it until. I would stop singing it if Donald Trump became president.
Oh.
And I'd sort of told everyone, you know, in the audience every night before the election that was what I would do. So as a kind of, you know, so I guess maybe secretly people hate that song. Anyways, but maybe that's what caused everything
to happen. They're trying to kill
the song. But then that happened and I didn't sing it for a while. But then, sadly, Leonard Cohen died, and so I brought it back, because death trumps Trump.
Yeah. So, speaking of Trump, this Sword of Damocles song and video, which is a great video, was this inspired for the midterms?
It was, it's interesting, because though it's addressed to the president, it's not about him necessarily. It's just, it's a song that I wrote during the whole process, before and after the election, where I, as well as many others, I think, had this deep sense of foreboding.
Yeah.
And even though we all, you know, were really excited about, you know, having the first female president, I think deep down we knew that something was off. Mm-hmm. So that's when the whole concept of the Sword of Damocles sort of arose. And I, you know, because I'd heard it mentioned here and there, namely by my old friend Carrie Fisher, who sadly passed as well. But she was talking about it in some conversation, and it just kind of stuck. And then the election happened, and I finished the song after that. And it's really about everybody, you know, and about just the general need for cataclysm that we're, you know, faced with now. And that, you know, even though I don't think it's been a fabulous outcome, I do think it's been a necessary one in order to just to come to terms with a lot of realities.
It's an interesting idea, yeah, that you have to go through suffering in order to have an epiphany, kind of.
So let's suffer, people, and have a great time.
Oh, we're suffering, that's for sure. You've written many, many songs, solo, collaborations, you've done artist works. Are you constantly writing songs? Is this something that you just do, or do you sit down and say, now it's time to write a collection of songs? Or how do you decide when you have an album?
I write all the time.
You just
Yeah, no, it's a never-ending...
happy or sad.
Yeah, it's a never-ending resource, hopefully never-ending, or at least it seems that way at the moment. And in a lot of ways, I mean, I will say that... not so much now, but there have been periods in my life where I've actually had to sort of step away from writing and just realize that I'm a human being and that I have to deal with, you know, some personal things like everybody else does. So I'm not really concerned about my creative output. Mm-hmm. And though that I think is initially a great thing, it does have its tribulations at times.
But how do you decide when you have an album? So you're constantly writing, because I remember there was a story about on your first record, you recorded 56 songs or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, for this last one, I'm working now with Mitchell Froom.
Oh, really?
The producer on my new album.
He's
and that'll come out in about a year's time. But yeah, so I'm doing that. And then, and I will say that for even this record, there's about, you know, 36 songs that I'm milling through, you know, in order to figure out which ones work. So
you always write
I always have a ton. How do you group
them? By theme, or is it just a...
Just by, you know, will they make money or not?
I don't think that's true.
In some form.
And how's that worked for you?
No, not well. To write a lot of songs. They all make a little bit of money.
Each one. Instead of a cash cow, it's a cash mouse. Yeah, this little squeak of mouth.
Cash ant farm.
So how did you get into writing operas? You've written two now.
Yes.
The latest one was just performed, this fall.
Yes,
congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, Hadrian was performed in Toronto by the Canadian Opera Company. Yep.
That seems like such a intimidating field of music that
I became a huge opera fanatic when I was about 13.
Okay.
So I've always loved that kind of music. And it was incredibly daunting. For a long time, the concept of it. But after a while, I figured, I don't know, I tend to put myself in that kind of position, insecure position, just to, get over it. So yeah, I know I wrote my first one, Prima Donna, and then things went well. And now I've written my second, and I'd like to write a third, and that's about it.
Okay.
I'll be done with opera. Concord opera, done.
You're going to have a trilogy and that's it. You're done. I think it's incredible that you did it. That seems like a crazy...
Well, you know what? One of the main things for me was I love orchestrating. And just being able to focus and learn about, you know, colors that an orchestra can provide was very exciting to me.
And did you have a lot of training doing that?
I mean, I went to music school briefly at McGill,
right.
But not a ton of training. I studied piano for many years, but you know, certainly with technology, the technology that's available today, it's a lot easier.
Yeah.
It's the time now.
One last question. I was looking back on your touring, and you've toured with some pretty amazing people. But it's a very eclectic group. It's like you toured with Roxy Music.
Yes, yeah, that was that was a great tour. Actually.
That's really cool. And then more recently, I mean, wasn't that recent? But you toured with Cyndi Lauper.
I've done shows with Cyndi Lauper.
Okay.
Yeah,
it wasn't a whole tour because
No, I think I did a few. I've worked with her on and off.
Really?
Here
we
and
just
there.
Had her drummer playing with us. That's why.
No, she's amazing. She's just timeless. Timeless energy.
That's pretty cool. I definitely admire some of your choices on that because I was like, wow, Roxy Music. I wouldn't think of that pairing for some reason. Not that it wouldn't work, but
yeah,
that's a really cool...
No, Roxy Music was great. That was a lot of fun.
I was a huge fan. That's why I was... Anyway, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.